Hear ye, hear ye, hear ye. The Supreme Court of the State of South Dakota, the Honorable David Gilbertson presiding, is now open for the transaction of any business that may legally come before it.
Good morning. The first case for oral argument this morning is Marsha Smithy, appellant versus Dakota Plains Ag Center and Nationwide Agribusiness, Appalese. For the appellant, we have Mr. Kenneth Birch, an attorney from Menno, South Dakota. And for the Appalese, we have Mr. Mark Arndt, an attorney from Sioux Falls. Mr. Birch, you may proceed, sir, and you have 20 minutes.
Thank you.
Please, the court, counsel. This is an appeal of a declaratory judgment action in which Nationwide, the workers' compensation carrier for Dakota Ag Farm Center, sought recovery of amounts they had paid out on a workers' compensation claim. Edward Smithy was the general manager of Dakota Plains. And in that capacity, they were looking at expanding a fertilizer plant that they owned. So he contacted a contractor that had originally built the fertilizer plant that they had. The contractor indicated that they were working on a facility near Worthing, south of Sioux Falls, and that he could come and visit that site at some point. One evening, after having attended a board meeting in Sioux Falls, he stopped by the plant. Now, this was November. It was 9:30 in the evening, so it was quite dark outside. Mr. Smithy exited his vehicle, and by the lights of his vehicle, he attempted to see the construction site. Unknown to him, there had been a pit dug approximately 12 feet in depth, and Mr. Smithy fell to that bottom of the pit. As a result of those injuries, he died the next day. There was no dispute that this was in the course of his employment, so Dakota Plains did pay, through their workers' compensation carrier, did pay workers' compensation benefits. Marsha Smithy, the widow of Edward Smithy, and the personal representative of his estate, brought an action against the contractor to recover damages. She alleged that they were negligent in failing to properly barricade the pit and also to light the pit. After several long time period of taking depositions, 17 depositions, I believe there were, the defendants in that action made a motion for summary judgment. What they were claiming was that they didn't breach their standard of care, and that argument hinged on whether Mr. Smithy was an invitee or whether he was a trespasser. Their argument was basically that it wasn't reasonable for him to assume he could go out there in the middle of the night and be invited to look at the construction site. Rather, they were limited to coming during the hours of work and the hours of daylight. They also claimed that when Mr. Smithy exited his vehicle, that he assumed the risk of any damage and was also contributory negligent. The summary judgment action was denied, and approximately 1 month prior to trial, a settlement conference was scheduled. Nationwide and Dakota Plains have been kept advised of the progress of the litigation by Smithy's counsel throughout the litigation, and they were invited to attend that settlement conference. They did not attend the settlement conference. They chose not to. They weren't successful settling the case that day, but approximately a week later, there was a second settlement conference, and again, Nationwide was asked to attend that conference, indicating the nature of the claim and that if the defense was successful, it would completely bar any recovery. Again, Nationwide...
Explain that to me, because I wasn't clear from the record when Nationwide first began to tell the estate that it was going to assert the full amount of the lien. Was that why they weren't going to the settlements? Were they making it clear?
They were making it clear from the first settlement conference that they believed that the amount that had been offered exceeded their lien and that they were entitled to recovery dollar for dollar from that settlement.
So Nationwide, consistently from the very beginning, from the very first settlement conference onward through the mediation and everything, had made it clear that they were not going to relinquish any portion of their lien.
That's correct.
Okay.
And I take it, at least for purposes of this appeal, you have no quarrel with the amount that was paid to your client by that workman's comp carrier.
That's correct.
All right.
Due to the risk of a possible verdict in favor of the defense, Marcia Smithy did elect to settle the case. Now, they settled that case for $1,090,000. They were forced to settle that case without getting a commitment from Nationwide as to a compromise on their settlement.
When they settled that case, did they know it was Nationwide's position that Nationwide would not compromise the lien?
Yes, Your Honor. They were not sure what a court might do when presented with their lien claimant, with their lien.
But there was no doubt as to Nationwide's position.
That's correct.
All right.
What happened next was Marcia Smithy filed a petition with the federal court asking to basically approve the settlement. This was necessary because there's two minor children involved that Mr. Smithy had left behind as well.
Why'd they do that in federal court?
Reading the statutes, it could have been brought in either court. There was out-of-state counsel for this underlying federal case. He could make arguments in the federal court, and that may have been a reason why they chose federal court rather than state court. When she filed that petition, included with that petition was her statement regarding Mr. Smithy's relationship with her, that they had a good marriage, that he was a loving father to the two young children that they had. Also attached to that petition were selected parts from her deposition outlining those same things. So the federal court was well informed of the relationship between Mr. Smithy and his family. It was at this point that Nationwide sought to intervene in the federal court, claiming that the court's decision on this matter could affect their ability to obtain recovery on their workers' compensation claim. The federal court indicated that, no, it was too late. They had had the opportunity to come in during settlement conferences, and they weren't going to allow them to come in now. The federal court did approve the petition and the allocation that was proposed by the Smithy estate. That allocation was 80% to pecuniary loss, and they specifically stated the loss of Eddie's society, companionship, protection, guidance, advice, and assistance. No mention was made of any economic loss in that petition. The remaining 20%, or $218,000, was allocated to economic loss. So what the Federal District Court said is, no, you've waited too long, you didn't attend settlement conferences, I'm not going to let you come in at this point. Nationwide then filed a second motion and asked it to reconsider its order approving settlement for the same reason. Again, the Federal District Court denied that motion. Now, what Nationwide represented to the Circuit Court, and I believe this court as well, is that the Federal District Court was indicating it was allowing Nationwide to come in and contest the amount that was allocated to pecuniary damages. What I'll grant that decision isn't exactly clear. In there it states that further the settlement agreement's apportionment of a portion of damages as pecuniary does not necessarily foreclose Nationwide from obtaining funds designated as such. Now, keeping in mind the settlement agreement in this case contained no reference to allocation of damages between pecuniary and economic. It was only the petition that had requested that. That decision goes on, and the district court states, to the extent that the allocation has an effect on Nationwide, the court finds that that effect would have been mitigated had Nationwide actively participated in the mediation when invited. The district court then quotes DOS 1 and states, only where the issue is fully and fairly tried before an impartial fact finder, and then puts in bold, or where the insurance carrier is invited to participate in settlement negotiations, unbolded, will such an allocation be given legal effect as to portions subject to the carrier's lien. So I think the federal court was telling Nationwide that you've had the opportunity, you were given the opportunity to come in at settlement, and you chose not to. For that reason, we're not now going to let you come in and try to argue against this widow and her children as to the allocation of damages. So based on that decision, my argument is that that was a final decision of the federal court. The state court should not now be allowed to come in and revisit that decision and change the allocation. I think this is a perfect opportunity for the court to tell insurance carriers, you can't force people to go to trial by sitting back and saying, no, we want 100% payment, and then after the settlement is completed, come in and try to expect payment for 100%.
Doesn't Zoss put the burden, though, on the plaintiff, not on the insurance company?
It does, Your Honor. I think the plaintiff, or the Smithy estate in this case, met that burden. It presented all the evidence to the federal court. It had attached the copies of the deposition of Marcia Smithy. So they had presented that information to the court. And I think the federal court was saying, if you're offered to come to a settlement conference and you choose not to, then don't come before us and complain about what may happen at that settlement conference.
By the same token, you could have brought them in as a third-party defendant to make the decision of a federal court binding upon them, couldn't you?
That's correct, although they were kept informed of the progress of the litigation throughout. And it was only a month prior to trial that the settlement conference was held. And then a week later, there was a second settlement conference. So we're talking 3 days before the trial. The Smithy estate needed to make a decision on what they were going to do to settle the case. They were caught between a rock and a hard spot in that there were some strong arguments for contributory negligence, and they could be zeroed out. They had advanced significant funds bringing the case to this point. Nationwide hadn't advanced any funds for this litigation. So the Smithy estate was forced to make a decision at that point.
As to the merits of the case, is there any authority that says the workman's comp carrier should have a reduction in their compensation if the liability is uncertain? That's not a factor, is it?
I believe that, it may not be a factor, but I think in any case that's settled, you never get 100% of what you believe the full damages may be. Now, there's several code sections in the workers' comp that talk about damages. Now, the one on 62.438 doesn't specifically mention recovering from like damages. 62.439 does indicate that the recovery of the workers' comp carrier is limited to like damages. In ZOS 1, this court indicated that those statutes are all construed together. And this court indicated that the benefits already paid are treated no different than future benefits. So Section 39, where it talks about future benefits, indicates they're restricted to like benefits. So I think this court has indicated that when you have a lawsuit, there you have pecuniary or some non-economic damages, and you have economic damages, and they need to, when there's a settlement, it's allocated between those non-economic damages as well. So if the insurance carrier chooses not to come into settlement, they're placing themselves at risk. And in I think it's important that if this court does say that the Nationwide was allowed to come in and argue whether there should be a different apportionment of these damages, that there be a hearing. If we assume that there's $2 million of economic damage and $4 million of non-economic or pecuniary damages, if there's a settlement for $1 million, it would seem reasonable that a third of that settlement should be allocated to economic damages and two-thirds to punitive rather than economic. So I think if you use that rationale in this case, then we need to allocate the damages between economic and non-economic damages so that the court can make a determination of that amount.
What kind of a record did you preserve at the circuit court level on that argument? In other words, when I assume it was Nationwide moved for summary judgment. Is that right?
Well, they had filed filed an action for declaratory judgment, set it up for hearing, and then I actually filed a motion for summary judgment indicating that the federal court had decided the issue and that all that was left was for the court to determine the allocation of the cost of the litigation.
Well, what did you do? I mean, if you move for summary judgment, that means you didn't want a hearing to prove up your damages.
I had moved for summary judgment as to the issue of whether it could be modified, the allocation of damages could be modified.
Well, what about the other issue that you say you want a hearing?
Yes.
You briefed that. How did you procedurally make sure that you were preserving your record on the right to have a hearing? Because
in my brief, I had indicated to the court that if the court were to allocate, change the allocation of damages, that we requested a hearing on that issue.
Did you identify issues of fact, a disputed fact about that?
Well, I think the...
as to what the proper allocation would be. Were there disputes of fact about that presented to the trial court?
Well, I think that was the whole argument as far as whether there could be a change in the allocation or not a change. And I think the circuit court in its decision never designated the difference between economic and non-economic damages in its decision. It just said Nationwide gets full recovery. It didn't differentiate between the two, and I think it's something that it needs to do. The other issue that I'd asked the court to look at was the issue of attorney's fees. The circuit court limited the attorney fees to 25% of the recovery. And where that comes from, there's the statute that talks about allocating the recovery about the workers' comp carrier on its recovery being responsible for a portion of the cost. That's 62.439. And then the last few words says subject to 62.736. Now, 62.736 deals with attorney's fees when there's action against the workers' comp carrier. And in there, it indicates that they're limited to 25% if there's a settlement, 30% if there's a hearing to the Department of Labor or to the circuit court, and 35% if there's an appeal to the Supreme Court. And then the last paragraph says, attorney's fees and costs may be paid in a lump sum on the present value of the settlement or adjudicated amount. So I believe it's just that last paragraph that that is meant to apply to 62-439. The reason being, it's fairly common for personal injury cases for a contingent fee to be a third of the recovery. I don't think the legislature intended to limit them in a personal injury case if there had been a workman's compensation claim made. I think it gets more complicated since in this case we did have a hearing in front of the circuit court. So does that mean we're now entitled to 30% instead of the 25% that the circuit court, originally ordered from the settlement? Now we're involved in appeal to this court. Does that mean now we're entitled to attorney's fees of up to 35%? So I think the logical interpretation of that statute is just means that if you settle a case and you have a structured settlement and the attorney's fees are paid up front, then now that it's presented for approval, it shouldn't the attorney's fees should not be limited.
Your time has expired, Mr. Birch. Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. Arndt, you have 20 minutes, sir.
Thank you, Your Honors, and counsel. May it please the court, I'm Mark Arndt of the Mann Johnson Law Firm of Sioux Falls on behalf of the plaintiff and appellee Nationwide Agribusiness. This case is in front of this court quite simply because the Smithy estate is attempting to recover both $1,090,000 in third-party settlement proceeds as well as over $486,000 worth of workers' compensation benefits. Despite the clear statutory prohibitions against those double recoveries as well as this court's clear rulings over the last few decades regarding or warning against double recovery, the Smithy estate is attempting to recover both, and that's why this case is in front of you. You've seen over the last few decades workers' compensation beneficiaries trying to be quite creative in ways to avoid the statutory liens that provide work comp benefits back to the insurance carrier.
However, let me ask you this on it. This is a death case, obviously, so you've got some kinds of damages that are obviously would not be covered by workers' compensation, the loss to the family. So how does, I mean, the double recovery there couldn't, that's not possible, is it?
Well, I suppose the court's question goes to whether or not those types of damages would be considered like damages under the ZOS formula or under the...
But I'm assuming, I mean, the going after the third party is for those damages not collected or not paid by workers' comp. So, I mean, you can't say that those are double.
Well, certainly...
Otherwise, there would be no reason to go after a third party for the plaintiff, is there? I mean,
well, certainly the settlement or the claim against the tortfeasors is going to cover a wide range of damages, including like damages and perhaps non-like damages. So I wouldn't dispute that with the court. I think that is common to any wrongful death claim. But having said that, given the amounts that we're discussing in this case and given the amount of the workers' compensation benefits that Nationwide was obligated to pay, I don't think there can be much question that there were sufficient economic as well as pecuniary, both economic and non-economic pecuniary damages that would have been more than Nationwide's workers' compensation.
But, you know, shouldn't that argument have been made in the federal court when they were working on it? I mean,
yeah.
Why didn't the insurance company participate at that point?
Because well,
if that is, you know, obviously that's part of the argument, why wasn't that made all at the same time?
And I think as the court is aware, the Nationwide did attempt to intervene at that stage of the proceeding, and I think it would have been in the interest of judicial economy to get it accomplished at that proceeding.
Why didn't they participate in the mediation, though?
Well, and I think first of all, I want to clarify when we say didn't participate in the mediation, I think the record is clear that Nationwide was having communications both with the Smithy Estates Council during mediation and with the mediator during that process. They simply didn't attend the mediation physically in person. And if you think of the practical decision as to why they didn't do that, again, Nationwide's position was the settlement amounts that the parties were considering were more than sufficient to cover Nationwide's workers' compensation lien. That was the decision.
I got the impression from reading the briefs that that the mediator, was that Mike Luce?
It was.
Made it very clear, though, to the insurance company that they should attend.
Well, I think Mr. Luce certainly wanted the insurance company to attend, but I think consider, put yourself in the mediator's shoes at that stage. He is there to bring all parties to the table that he possibly can to squeeze as much money from all of those parties as he possibly can to reach a settlement. He was not the mediator selected by Nationwide. His fees weren't being paid by Nationwide. The mediator was there to solve the case between the third-party tortfeasors as well as the Smithy estate. His motive was not to act in Nationwide's best interest or even fairly to Nationwide. His motive was to get Nationwide to the table and see if he couldn't squeeze some money out of them to contribute to a settlement.
Go ahead.
Well, you're out there in the doing this day to day. Is this typical that the workers' compensation carrier would never attend a mediation and just dig in its heels and say, you owe us everything and we're not going to participate? Or do they normally participate in the mediation?
Well, certainly there are circumstances where it's in their benefit to participate. But I don't think it's uncommon or unheard of that they wouldn't participate under these figures, under the amounts that we're discussing. I mean, if you put yourself in Nationwide's shoes, they understood the amounts of settlement that were being considered in this case. They understood the full amount of their lien. They understood South Dakota's law providing clear statutory and precedential authority that they did not, if their workers' compensation lien was covered by a settlement amount so large that their lien would be protected, it really didn't make much sense for them to send some claims manager from a Des Moines office to sit in a mediation for multiple days in Sioux Falls and say, no, we're not going to compromise our workers' compensation lien. We don't have incentive to do that. The settlements amounts you're discussing, given the facts of this case, don't encourage Nationwide to compromise their lien. They simply didn't have any motive to do that.
Isn't that hard-nosed position taken by your company forcing the plaintiff to go for broke? In other words, why settle for, when the damages exceed $1 million, why settle for $1 million, even though you might get nothing? All you're accomplishing there is reimbursing the workman's comp carrier, and so they have to look at that lawsuit as to the value of it and what they can recover. The only way to force the workman's comp carrier into coming down on their settlement is by saying, well, we're going to go to trial, and if we get zeroed out, you lose your $500,000. And now, do you want to talk or not? So, but isn't your hard-nosed position forcing them to take risks to go to trial just for a chance to recover their damages?
I don't think the risk is any different in that circumstance, Your Honor, than it would be in any other case where there's disputed liability. I mean, there are pros and cons as to why of going to trial and the risk of a jury determining liability against the plaintiff, and they would recover nothing. Keep in mind that this is workers' compensation benefits that Nationwide had already agreed and committed to pay. So there's no question that the Smithy estate was going to, at a minimum, recover that workers' compensation benefits.
I know, but why should the plaintiff, be anxious to settle their claim for less than what it might possibly be worth just to reimburse the workman's comp carrier for something that's already been paid and something they already have?
Well, again, I suppose if the figures were different, it would certainly make sense for the workers' compensation carrier to take a different position. But under the figures, I'm trying to answer the question as forthright as I can, under the figures of this case, in settlement amounts that were discussed that were in millions of dollars, it simply didn't make sense for Nationwide to say, we're going to compromise our workers' compensation lien. I hope I addressed the court's question if I understand it, but I don't believe the risk-benefit analysis is any different from the plaintiff's perspective than it would be when there's not a workers' compensation lien. I mean, they need to go through their analysis of what the value of our case is worth, and that includes a factor of liability as it would in any case. I think part of the discussion so far this morning from the opposing counsel has been focused on what happened at the federal district court level. And I would suggest to this court that even accepting the federal district court's decision on this issue, which ultimately Nationwide had to do because they weren't allowed to intervene at that stage, the federal district court allocated over $800,000 towards pecuniary damages and over $200,000 towards economic damages. That was per the request of the Smithy estate. Even given those figures, as the circuit court in this case clearly set forth in their order and their lengthy findings of fact and conclusions of law, even under those figures, there was plenty of economic or at least like damages under the statute that fully compensated Nationwide for their lien. And that is why the circuit court made the ruling that it did. I think one of the representations was, or one of the questions was, some of the facts that were developed at the circuit court level. I would remind the court, I think it is attached as Exhibit D to the Smithy Estate's initial brief. There is a lengthy set of findings of fact and conclusions of law entered by Judge Ng at the circuit court level, 49 paragraphs worth, specifically going through the facts of this case and then also the analysis under the Zoss formula authored by Justice Sabers back in 1998. So there is, and I would also suggest that if I were drafting a brief on this opinion, those findings of facts would be quite helpful in going through the analysis. It can be difficult to understand. The Zoss formula can be complex, but the court did make those steps and did walk through that formula in its findings of fact and conclusions of law. Now, if I may, the findings of facts begin going through the Zoss formula at paragraph 40. And beginning at paragraph 40, the circuit court recognized that expenses and attorney fees need to be calculated. Nationwide clearly understands that it does have an obligation to pay the Smithy Estate a portion of the attorney fees and expenses incurred by the Smithy Estate in pursuing the third-party tortfeasor. Paragraphs 41 and 42 of the findings of fact, and more specifically conclusions of law, deal with the first step in the Zoss formula, and that is prorating the expenses between the two parties. The Zoss case clearly sets forth that we take a portion of those expenses. In this case, $486,000, roughly, of workers' compensation benefits is 44.7% of the $1,090,000 settlement.
Now, you prevailed at the circuit court level on a motion for summary judgment, correct?
Actually, it was the caption of the matter was a lien to declare, or a motion to declare the workers' compensation lien. We didn't file a summary judgment motion. We filed a motion to declare the workers' compensation lien.
Okay. And the other side is saying they didn't get a full and fair opportunity to litigate this issue. What's your response?
Well, I believe they did, and I think as the court recognized, number one, that is the Smithy Estate's burden, first of all. They could have done a number of things to make a more full record. They could have done it at the district court level. They could have done it at the circuit court level. They could have filed their own declaratory judgment action at any stage in these proceedings to make their full record.
Well, they requested it in their brief to the court.
They did.
Said if we don't win on the issue as a matter of law, then we want a chance to prove it up.
Well, I would encourage the court to read the transcript. I know it's part of the record from the hearing in front of Judge Ng at the circuit court level, because I think the court went out of its way to ask counsel and the Smithy Estate at that hearing if they wanted to present any other issues or if there was any other evidence that they felt like they needed to present. And that was not accomplished. That request was not made. Nor even after the court's ruling or the court's signing of the order or the findings and conclusions, did anyone move for an additional hearing or a motion to reconsider. I'll even suggest to the court that I don't believe the Smithy Estate submitted opposing findings of fact and conclusions of law. So there were multiple opportunities, I believe, for the Smithy Estate to make any additional factual record that they wished to make. They didn't put on any evidence at the hearing. They had an opportunity to do so, but just a reference in a brief that they would like an additional hearing without something more, I don't believe is sufficient to protect their record for wanting to put on additional facts. Let's assume that the Smithy estate could have put on additional facts. Again, our position would be this court has more than enough evidence to make a ruling based on the record that we have in front of you, even despite the fact that it is the Smithy estate's burden, given what the Smithy estate attempted to accomplish at the federal court level with their own economic expert declaring that their economic loss was between $2 to $2.4 million, there is more than enough evidence to indicate that there is in excess of $486,000 of like damages that would entitle Nationwide to full recovery of its lien. Would like to address with the court one additional issue, maybe of a practical nature when considering its opinion. I think everyone would like some finality as we move forward with this case. It's been long and it should have been resolved quite some time ago. But in any event, again, the numbers are such that the Nationwide has committed to $486,873 worth of workers' compensation benefits. The court, at the circuit court level, subtracted the prorated attorney fees and prorated expenses to get to the figure of the $349,770. That's the lien amount. When you subtract those two figures, it comes to a figure of $137,103. That's the true amount that Nationwide owes to the Smithy estate. That's the attorney fees and the prorated expenses that Nationwide owes to the Smithy estate. Now, because this is a workers' compensation claim, Nationwide has been paying out benefits from quite some time, from the time of Edward Smithy's death or shortly thereafter in November of 2003. Nationwide and continues to pay those benefits. Nationwide has paid an amount, I know it's not part of the formal record, but I'll represent to the court, in excess of that $137,103. I'm going to estimate for the court it's somewhere in the $160,000 to $170,000 range and is obligated to continue to pay those benefits. But again, if the court agrees with the circuit court on this issue, the true amount that Nationwide owes to the Smithy estate is the $137,103, and for clarity purposes, we would respectfully request that the court advise the parties that once Nationwide has paid that amount, the prorated attorney fees or prorated expenses and attorney fees, that its obligation to continue to pay workers' compensation benefits cease. Otherwise, we may be back in front of the Department of Labor or even the circuit court asking for clarification as to how the lien ultimately gets resolved.
Isn't that where you should go first to resolve that? Okay. I mean, the circuit court didn't rule on that issue, did they?
They did not.
Yeah.
No, they did not. But, no, I mean, with all due respect, Your Honor, I understand and appreciate the question, but I think the record was such and the facts were agreed upon that it was appropriate for the circuit court to make the ruling that it did. I think even as stated in both parties' briefs towards the beginning, the facts in this case are largely agreed upon. There aren't issues of facts that are going to make or break how this issue is determined, and I think both parties in their briefs you'll see agreed upon that. Ultimately, this is a case that should not have gotten this far. It should have been resolved, but I do think there was a practical problem of out-of-state counsel understanding the workers' compensation lien system in South Dakota. Certainly there are other states that do not allow or do allow double recovery of workers' compensation benefits and settlement proceeds from third-party tortfeasors. That is not South Dakota law, and for whatever reason, we could not get out of state counsel to understand or come to that recognition. Nevertheless, it is illogical to allow the Smithy estate at the district court level, when they're attempting to negotiate their claim with the third-party tortfeasors, to say our economic damages are between $2 and $2.4 million, then accept the $1 million settlement, turn around the next day to the district court and say, actually, our economic damages are only $218,000. And that's what they did. That was their attempt to avoid the workers' compensation lien by declaring that very small amount of economic damages as they petitioned the district court for approval of the settlement. Their expert one day said, it's over $2 million. they turn around the next day to the district court and say, no, it's actually only $200,000. It would be illogical to allow the Smithy estate to get away with that. And it would not meet the ends of justice. More importantly, it would avoid the clear statutory authority of 62-438 and 62-439. I would, with my 1 minute left, quickly address the issue of attorney fees specifically set forth in 62-736 as addressed by opposing counsel. Quite frankly, I believe this court is well aware that if the statutes on their face are read plainly and can be interpreted plainly, the court does not need to go into some interpretation of legislative intent. And I believe that's what these statutes provide. 62-439 refers to 62-736 for prorating or determining the amount of attorney fees. And subsection 1 of 62-736 clearly states the amount is 25% if there is a settlement at trial or before trial. And those were the undisputed facts in this case. There was a settlement before trial. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Arndt. Mr. Bruce, you have 10 minutes. Before you get going, I have a question based on Mr. Arndt's presentation this morning. You have said that you did not get a full and fair hearing in front of Judge Ng, despite the request for one. He's saying that there was not a summary judgment granted. It was a hearing on the merits, that the judge invited you to present anything further. Nothing was presented, and then you failed to protect your record by submitting either objections or proposed findings of fact. What's your response?
The way the hearing was scheduled that day, it was on a regular court day of the circuit court. We were allocated, I think, a half hour for the hearing. That indicated why in my brief to the court, I indicated that if the court is going to consider a different allocation of the damages, we would request a hearing on that matter so that we could present additional information. We had believed at that point that the federal district court's allocation should not be modified. And rather than asking the court for a day of the court's time to consider the matter of allocation, we chose instead to present the arguments to the judge, and then should he decide that yes, we can allocate those damages differently, then we can go ahead and have a different day for that hearing. So it was more in the interest of judicial economy that we didn't present all kinds of evidence that day regarding allocation of damages.
How could you take a position different than what you took in federal court as did the number of economic damages based on your own expert?
We weren't you're talking about the allocation of the damages?
Yep.
Okay. We weren't necessarily taking a position differently. We were just indicating that there needs to be an allocation of damages. I believe in the letter that Mr. Luce had to the insurance company, he indicated approximately 10% is what would be their portion of the total recovery if we were successful. So we didn't ask for 10% like Mr. Luce had indicated to the insurance company. Instead, the Smithy estate looked at it and asked for 20%. Again, the federal district court was presented with the deposition of Marcia Smithy, so they had the opportunity to consider that. And after looking at that, they agreed that yes, they could. This was a reasonable allocation. I think what the federal district court was doing was saying, insurance company, if you don't come to the settlement table and negotiate in good faith, then don't expect to come in front of us and be heard as far as your position on matters like this.
Just a minute. Stop. Timer's not working. 2 minutes. Do you think you can go in 2 minutes?
That would be fine.
Okay. Set it for 8 minutes. Sorry for the interruption. You're up and running.
Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Arndt started his argument indicating that South Dakota law doesn't allow a double recovery, and we acknowledge that. Some of the problem in the case, he had referred to out-of-state counsel, and what out-of-state counsel had done was when it looked at the amount of economic damage, it applied the whole amount of cost, attorney's fees and cost in collection of the action against that amount. That total was, I believe, in the neighborhood of $350,000. $218,000 was allocated to economic damages. So in his view, that completely wiped out any right to reimbursement that Nationwide may have had. In my presentation to the circuit court, as well as my presentation, my brief to this court, I indicated that it's more appropriate to use a pro-rata reduction of attorney's fees. And in page 16 of my brief, I do go through and apply that ZOS formula to the $218,000. So it's not that we're asking for a double recovery here. It's just more a matter of what amount do we apply the ZOS formula to determine the amount of reimbursement that Nationwide is entitled to. So we have not tried a double recovery. We're just asking for a fair recovery in this case. And I think the problem with the case throughout, from the time the first settlement conference was scheduled until the present, is that Nationwide has taken the position that they get reimbursed dollar for dollar first, and then whatever's left over goes to the Smithy estate. The affidavit of Patrick Wars indicates that based upon Nationwide's understanding that the Smithy estate was seeking a settlement with the tortfeasors in amount in excess of Nationwide's lien amount, Nationwide refused to compromise its lien claim. So they acknowledge that they refused to compromise its lien.
Well, that's been their position all the way through, hasn't it?
It has. It has. And as I indicated to the court earlier, I believe that a reading of the statutes, the 62-438 through 62-440, if you read those statutes together, the lien only attaches to like damages. So it's not that Nationwide gets dollar for dollar. They only get reimbursement from the economic portion. And that's why it's necessary for the court to make an allocation of those damages. We believe that that's exactly what the federal district court did. They did an allocation of the damages, and now what was left was for the circuit court to apply the cost to that allocation of damages and determine the amount that Nationwide gets reimbursed.
Well, you know, one of the other problems, it doesn't look to me like the federal court got it right either, because the federal court apparently didn't understand our decision in ZOS, which says that pecuniary damages aren't limited to economic or to non-economic damages. And for some reason, you sought an allocation based on pecuniary versus economic, and that isn't the correct allocation. It's got to be economic versus non-economic.
And I think the petition, when it asked for pecuniary damages, it set forth certain items that was set forth in it in the petition. There were no economic damages set forth in the petition that they asked to be allocated to pecuniary damages. The only economic damages in the petition indicated they should be assigned as economic damages. So I think that the federal court fully understood that what was being allocated to pecuniary did not include any of those loss of earning capacity damages that had been shown. I guess in conclusion, Your Honors, you have some questions.
No, I was just going to say nobody's ever chastised for quitting early. You look like <over your head. laughs>
Sometimes you just need to know when to sit down and shut up. I do thank you for your consideration and and hearing this morning.
Thank you, Mr. Birch. Court will be in recess for 10 minutes.